Morning, everyone. Well, it might not be morning when you hear this. This is Tim at North and South Podcasts. Hope you're all well. Today, I've got resident culture vulture, woke warrior, David Moorhead. I can take some of that out if you want, David. This is his third one, and we're going to be chatting about books like last time, but also about maybe just general cultural stuff, films, TV. I hope you find this useful. Don't forget, if you want to come on to the podcast to talk about creativity, politics, history, financial survival, well-being, anything really, get in touch via Twitter or if you know me personally that way. So, David, how are you doing and what's the latest with your play and your creative stuff?
Right. Good morning and thank you very much for having me back. Not many people do. The play's going really well, Forgotten Voices, which is the story of my grandmother, Eva Moorhead Kodaly. She was on the forefront of tackling racism in South Africa. She was married to Clements Kodaly, the first national black trade union leader. And the play is her story. It's a one-woman show performed brilliantly by Charissa Valentine, who recently was on BBC Doctors. And next month, can't believe it actually, because it's on the 1st of October, we start a national UK tour of seven different cities, which is really, really exciting. We start in Birmingham on the 1st of October, and on the 5th of October, we're actually in Manchester Cathedral. We've been invited there to launch their Black History Month and to do the play, which is really, really exciting. And then we tour the Lake District. We're going to London, going to Cambridge, we're going to Chester, and we're going to the new Shakespeare North Playhouse in Prescott. So it's all fantastic.
I've got a ticket for one of the Prescott nights, so I look forward to that in October. And again, we'll put details up of the venues for the play. I watched it during lockdown. I watched the video version and I really enjoyed it. Some good history and very strong character. And I think during lockdown, I realised how much I missed like performances, etc. And it was just nice to see a performance in a theatre, even though, you know, I wasn't in the actual audience and I really enjoyed it. But I think to see it in the flesh, I'm looking forward to that, to meet that person again. You know, I just think that the acting was brilliant. The script was very good and the history was a big part of it. And that ticks all the boxes for me. So best of luck with that and let us know how it goes.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's been a lot of hard work though. Yeah. And I didn't realise how big a task it was to take your show on a UK tour. But it's been great. Yeah. And we look forward to meeting loads of people as we travel through the country.
Excellent. And let us know how that goes. Have you got anything else in the pipeline or any other things you're doing at the moment?
I have got a children's book, which I have nearly finished the second draft of, and I'm working with Golden Egg Academy on that. So hopefully next year, 2023, I might have some really, really good news.
Excellent.
But the it's a teen novel about children in care and also the role of anger, because often children can be very angry because of injustice or different circumstances. But I wanted to explore the positives of anger, because anger against injustice, and if we stand up and channel our anger. So they're the two things of children in care and looking at the role of anger and it making our identity.
That's particularly good, because as well as looking at children in care and the difficulties they often have, I think anger is something that it's an emotion we experience every day. I'm actually doing a really good online course with a guy called Paul Cope at the minute, and he discusses anger and says, you know, anger is a positive thing. It's when it manifests itself as rage, where you externalize it and, you know, damage other people, that it causes problems. But that's a big part of the kind of well-being thing that I want to discuss and bring out more and more, how we can manage things like anger. I've done an episode on equanimity, and I've got a lot of interesting people on, and I want to get people on as well. But also there's a lot of issues with neurodiversity and ADHD, and some of us are often quite quick to anger more than others. And You look at prison populations tend to have a lot of men from difficult backgrounds, often with mental health difficulties and ADHD. Apparently, a lot of people with ADHD end up in prison. But it's a very, very live issue, and it's an issue that affects everyone. So I think that you're tapping into the universal layer and also looking at a particular group who, we both know as teachers, they often experience a lot of difficulty, young people in care, etc., finding a place in the world. And, it really is a difficult thing for someone to not have those roots in their youth. It can be very, very difficult, can't it? So is that something that's interested you for a long time?
Yes, I think it's the idea of we all have to find our place in the world, but I think we have to find ourselves first and then be an authentic person in the world. And I think this idea of some of us are quick to anger, but I think then the idea of anger is bad. Don't be it. Be placid, be obedient, etc. You'll be better. I don't think that's really right either. So I think it's the idea that we search for who we are and then we use our talents to create the best world for us and other people.
Absolutely.
And I mean, social services, child services, the funding is so poor that it's just truly awful. And I think so many children who sadly end up in care and it's not their fault deserve so much better from this country. And I think if we
Absolutely.
want to make this country great, we start looking at the vulnerable children and make sure that they don't fall through the cracks. Because I think if you're not adopted by the age of five, right, the chances are you won't be. And then you go through all your life unwanted, moving from foster care to foster care. And then you're suddenly on your own as a vulnerable young person, especially girls, is really worrying. So looks at those issues.
Very, very important. And I think lockdowns exacerbated a lot of that. I think that the general funding for a lot of our key services, one of the real disadvantages of this kind of like populist governments we've had, or this general populism in the UK since 2016 in particular, is really important issues are hidden in plain sight and not discussed. The NHS at the moment, I was speaking to someone recently about treatment that they received, or received in brackets, in the hospital and through care support. Absolutely disgusted me. And it's not even, I mean, there is a bit of mention like, oh, the NHS is in crisis, but it seems not to matter. What seems to matter is like, oh, let's have a go at, trans rights, or, if you haven't closed down your shop or put something on Facebook with the death of the Queen, etc., they're the big issues. And those issues are important to discuss. But the way that things are just hidden in plain sight in this country, and there seems to be no political impact on the government for neglecting these things, I think is absolutely disgusting. And I think that's the role of art. We're here to discuss culture and art. Like, art imitates life, life imitates art. You can bring a lot of these issues out. I think it was Ronald Reagan who said art should not be political, which is the most absurd political and artistic statements I've ever heard from anyone, because often art is one of the key ways that you can actually talk about issues out in the open and bring it to audiences at quite a developed level. And who wants to live in societies where you can't do that? People go on about freedom of speech. That's the ultimate freedom of speech, when people can express themselves in any way they want through art, etc. So keep up the good work, and best of luck with that project.
Thank you.
Right, the secret history. Yesterday, I can't believe this. And yesterday I was in a school. I'm working as a supply teacher at the moment. I was in a school, and there was a student going to lesson reading The Secret History by Donna Tartt. Now, I knew that we were doing this today, and we both mentioned that it's one of our favorite books. So I read to this student, wow, who got you onto that? Anyway, she's halfway through it, said she was enjoying it. But I listened to the last podcast. I don't think we really explained what the secret history is, but we don't want to give the game away, do we? So what I would say is, once you start this book, every sentence is loaded. It's like the Goldfinch, which I read fairly recently, one of her and other novels, Donna Tartt, and we discussed how much she put into every novel. It's like heart and soul kind of stuff. So how would you describe The Secret History? Because it is a difficult book to summarise, isn't it?
Yeah, I think The Secret History basically is about people going to university.
Yeah.
Some people are incredibly bright, but some people are quite arrogantly bright.
Yeah.
And some tutors help everyone and some favour a few. So if we take the idea of the ego of students and the ego of a teacher, and we put them in a university setting, and then we add in a murder.
Yeah.
The idea is that will their ego believe that they not only are the top of the academic hierarchy in the university, but they could get away with murder, that they are above everything.
Yeah.
And then the group, united by their elitism, turn on each other. And it explores that. But I think where Donna Tartt's genius is the writing. It is just so beautiful and so engaging. And I was in Waterstones, where they have YA, the young adult section, has just expanded over since lockdown. And then they're trying to encourage them to read adult novels, right? And The Secret History is one of those they're promoting.
Yeah, I mean, there's quite a lot of like references to drug taking and things like that in it. And I remember thinking about this child, like reading it in school. I thought, well, she, you know. But when you think about it, it's almost like we try to overprotect people these days. When I was young, it was that kind of gradual exposure to those kind of things through art and through TV when you were younger. It didn't normalize it. It just made you aware of these issues in the background. And I think it's very educational for a young audience to read it for the social issues explored. Did I lend you the Continuum Classics, which is like a modern equivalent of York Notes about The Secret History? Did I lend it that to you? Or
yes.
That was really good because they explored themes which I didn't see and looked at different things. But the beauty at the start of the novel is it's about this group, and it's very much a case of, you know, in life, I experienced it myself at university. We had like a group of us who kind of really gelled and came together at university, and we still meet regularly, and we've still got a WhatsApp group. It made me identify with that. And Donna Tartt describes it as, you know, when there's a group of people in a particular place at a particular time, and that togetherness is just beautiful. And it's kind of enhanced by the academic rigor of the history tutor in the book, and also the interest in like the classics. There's that kind of like this real appreciation of the Greeks, the ancient Greeks and the Greek gods. And that actually informs the murder in a supernatural and magical realist way. And I think I don't want to say any more than that about what later happens, but the book is just, I don't think you can write two books like that in any single lifetime. I just think it just had so much depth to it and revelation. I don't know. I find it hard to describe it. But I actually had it on my shelf for about 3 years before a friend lent it to me. And he said, oh, you've got to read this. And I left it on my shelf for 2, 3, 4 years. And then I picked it up and I thought, wow, this is truly incredible. It'd be an interesting film to see made into a film, but I don't know whether I would feel about that, but I think everyone says that about when books are turned into films, don't they?
I also think, it's set in Vermont, and it's set in the winter. Mm. So the university is a character, but the weather is as well. And you also, I felt when I went to university, it is a different world. You are journeying into a different world with different values. And you find yourself reading the book thinking, I wouldn't do that. Oh, I don't think they should do that. Oh, should they do that? And that was quite good. And that people that you think are like you and would have the same values, you find out don't, dramatically don't. And I think that's really engaging and makes you think and question. So I like that aspect as well.
There's a chapter or two where the main characters by themselves during the winter, and they describe how cold it is as well. I think did he end up in like an apartment that hasn't got like heating on or
Yeah.
something? And the detail and the description of just the day to day, I have seen that in a few books. Like people often say Chekhov's quite good at the mundane descriptions, but I don't know if you've read The Time Traveler's Wife. That the way she describes like making a cup of coffee and just the little things people do during the day. Donna Tartt does that throughout the book as well, where the description of the mundane becomes beautiful in itself. And I think that doesn't make a novel by itself, but if you combine that with a really good story and a good narrative and great character, it's an exponential improvement, isn't it? So basically, listeners, you need to read the Donna Tartt book, The Secret History, and also read her other books as well. So what books have you been reading recently, then?
I've got three. A Kind of Spark by Elle McNicol is a children's book. It's one for 8 to 12 year olds, but adults can read this. And A Kind of Spark is about a girl in Scotland who is 11 and she has autism. And it's about her life in school, who supports her, who doesn't. But also in her Scottish village, hundreds of years ago, women who were different, who had a different kind of spark, were executed as witches. And she is determined that there will be a plaque in the village to apologize for the fact that the patriarchy targeted women who were different, made them feel inferior, and that there should be justice. So you've got a parallel with her campaign, what they did hundreds of years ago to ordinary women who were interested in science or who had learning difficulties, who didn't conform. There's that, and there's also her struggles in school, where some of the children and some of the teachers aren't very supportive. But it is great. It's great to give to children. And, my book club did it, and five adults all loved it. It's a really positive but thought-provoking book. So that's my first one.
That's excellent. And I think some of the I read Northern Lights by Philip Pullman, which was actually written for teenagers. And I think that there probably are quite a few people who say, oh, I don't really read a book that's aimed at younger people or teenagers, but they're missing out. Some of the best books I've read, obviously, I've got a very young son. I know you've got children, and you would have read books with them when you were very young. But some children's books I read are just like, wow, this is amazing. The plot, and because you don't realize it when you're a child, but as an adult looking at them, they can be absolutely phenomenal, can't they?
I think children's literature since Harry Potter, right, and especially in the last 6, 7 years, has become more sophisticated and more powerful. And because children's attention span is limited, the books themselves, they've had to write better. So they've had to write sharper, more intriguing plots, stronger personalities, more characters, etc. And it has lifted. I really feel there's a lot of snobbery about children's books, but often the children's books I read, I'm more impressed with than the adults. But I am now going to talk about an adult book. It's called Still Life by Sarah Winman, right? And this is an amazingly positive book. Now, like I did read Sugie Bain by Douglas Stewart, which is brilliant, but it's bleak. Set on a council estate, a young lad growing up with an alcoholic mother. It's bleak from beginning to end. The character arc is just misery, right? And I find many adult books go down that route. But Still Life is really, really positive. And it's about two people who meet in Florence at the end of the war, and it's their lives. One is a lesbian artist, and the other is an ordinary Cockney lad who goes back after the war to run a pub. Now, as I'm describing it, you're probably thinking this sounds so boring. And it is the perfect storm of how not to write a novel, because it doesn't sound anything. and it's just their lives intertwined over 60 years. And most of the time, it's telling, not showing. It's very, very upbeat, but it's incredibly, incredibly charming, uplifting, and really powerful. And I thought I would hate it. It's not a book I would go for. I thought it'd be too sentimental. It's very European in its celebration of Florence and London, and it's just an absolute delight. And if you wanted to escape and feel positive, Still Life is brilliant. And because she's an artist, she comments on still life that often when artists put pictures together, like you might paint a bowl of fruit, they often put very male things in still life pictures because it's about patriarchy controlling everything, even down to art, you know. But it's brilliant, and it's got a talking parrot.
A talking parrot that always adds to it, doesn't it? I think, I mean, I think the origins of theatre, as we know, you know, like the Greeks would go and see, you know, tragedies or comedies, and the comedies were designed to make them laugh, and the tragedies made them think about the difficulties in their own life. And I think you're right about the sometimes adult novels seem to have either, you know, a lot of misery and then a nice little conclusion at the end to just cheer us up a little bit, or like, you know, Sugar Bane, it might be bleak throughout, and both of them have their place. But sometimes I read children's books and it's like this unbelievably positive story, and you're thinking, oh, come on, you know, it's not quite like this, the real world. And maybe it's nice to tell them these little stories when they're young and that makes them better when they're older, etc. But I think it's hard to say, isn't it, what great art is? I mean, I wouldn't really watch comedies in terms of a film comedy, but I would, with Nail and I is my favourite film, which is like a black comedy, you know what I mean? And sometimes you can say, oh, that's not really my bag. And I often find when I get a good recommendation of someone I trust, that's usually the best indication of a book, even if it's like from a field or a particular genre that I wouldn't like. I'm just going to tell you one of my books, and you may well have read this book. I'm rereading Cat's Eye by Margaret Atwood. And I actually read this for A level English literature, and I don't know whether you've experienced this, but you know, you do your lower school qualifications and you don't really get into things in tremendous depth. Well, the books I read for English literature left a really deep impression on me, and the stuff I studied in history at A level, it was like history. You know what we were talking about, like in The Secret History, where they love the subject and they all meet and they discuss it at a very high intellectual level. A level did that for me. And this book, I didn't really appreciate it as much at the time because it's quite postmodern and the chronology is back and forth throughout the main character, Elaine's life. But absolutely fantastic, Cat's Eye. I mean, most people who I've known have read Atwood have read The Handmaid's Tale, which is absolutely outstanding. But this book, Cat's Eye by Margaret Atwood, if you want to read a book about like childhood bullying, being young, she describes being a traveller in her youth as well and having to move around a lot around Canada in her youth, and a description of nature and a description of like the snow when the snow falls just leaves these beautiful images in your head. And then it goes back and forth to the present day where the character is older, and this bullying that happened in her youth is kind of like the name in the rock, you know, like Brighton Rock or Blackpool Rock. Throughout her whole life, this bullying and its implications stay with her right through life. And it's about how she comes to terms with them. It's about power among young people and how the dynamics change. It's about relationships. But when she's older, she becomes an artist, painting art, etc. And it's about like the art market and things like that. But I'm halfway through it, and it's just an absolutely beautiful novel. And well done to whoever put it on the A-level English literature syllabus, because I don't think I'd have read that ever if I hadn't have done it then. So that's a great book. Have you read any Atwood or?
Only this in the when I was at uni in the 80s, another student said, "Oh, Margaret Atwood, you must read her." So I read Lady Oracle, and I also read Surfacing. And although I thought surfacing was brilliant, all about the idea that women are forced to wear makeup as a shield. They can't be themselves, and this woman goes away for the weekend, and that's all the book is. Her going away for the weekend with her boyfriend, but he insisting that she be perfect and look great for him. And she swims naked in a lake and surfaces out with no makeup, and then decides that she will be a woman in her own terms, and not to please him, and leaves him. I thought that was a brilliant book.
Yeah,
You
that's that sounds so outwardly, like, doesn't it? This idea of this, like, rebirth, this awakening, if you like, because often people, not only do people have external pressures on them to behave in a certain way, and this is every human being in any group, basically, but there's a lot of internal pressure. People internalize things, and often one of the great examples is like people who wear particularly a particular religious clothing, and then people say, "Oh, that's taking away your liberty of freedom." And they say, "Well, this is how I want to dress." And really, that's fine. You know, who's to say that people can't behave in a particular way, one way or the other? But I often look at particular people in particular groups, and I think when you're a bit older, you feel a bit more liberated from it, where you look at, say, young girls and say, "You must have taken hours upon hours upon hours of preparation to dress up that way." And for me, I don't care how you dress it up, that is a restriction of freedom. And it may well be internalized, and they may say that they want to do that. But I think it's good that people like Atwood can explore that in a book in that fashion, because
I wish surfacing was a much more popular Atwood read than it is. I think it's one of her lesser well-known books. I also read Alias Grace about the murder. I would say though, right, I don't really like open-ended books sometimes, and that's my only criticism of her, is sometimes some of her books are open-ended. But I did see her interviewed when she was asked by two young writers, had she any advice? And she said, yes, think about your hands and arthritis and everything, because you spend hours typing. And she said, you know, you've got to do exercise, you've got to look after your body. And I thought that was a brilliant piece of advice, because so many writers do struggle with that, and it's never addressed.
Again, that's typical Margaret Atwood, is being asked that kind of question, responding that way. But she looks at, she scratches the surface, and as you say, she's very postmodern. She messes around with like structure and stuff, but I think that there's a lot of power in that. But as you say, it's not for everyone. I don't think she's an easy person to read either. I think there's a certain level that you have to get into a style, and then you're like, wow, this is amazing. Because I've started another one of her books and stopped because I just couldn't get my head around it, which I'd like to revisit again in the future. She also did some great poetry. I think it was called Circle Time, and we did a bit of that for our A-level studies, and that was really, really good. Again, experience. She kind of looks at power dynamics in like the colloquial day-to-day, and I think that's a good theme to study, because this is everyone's lives every single day. And I think she's beautiful for that. One of the strengths of that approach is, and you see this far more now in modern literature and drama and TV, is there are grey areas expressed through the main story now. Because I often look at films from back in the day where there's a very like start, middle, end, and they almost seem quite limited. Do you do that looking at old films, think, you know, it's a little bit straightforward, this, because there are so many subtleties and grey areas. I'll tell you the great film, Mississippi Burning, great film. But like throughout the whole film, it's like they're the baddies. There's no two ways about it. And they're the goodies. There's no two ways about it. There's a little bit of overlap. But I do think that the complexity of these kinds of issues needs to be explored in the grey areas, because what you do then is you get people thinking, even if people might be quite critical of a particular approach, you can get everyone thinking by exploring the kind of two-way approach. And I watched a film recently, a Ridley Scott film, with the young actress from Liverpool, Jodie Comer is in it, Adam Driver, Matt Damon, they're in it, and it's about a duel to the death during the 100 Years' War. And the film is split into chunks, looking at it from each character's perspective. Absolutely brilliant. You know, that subtlety in the overlap. And I think that's a great thing to do in novels, to acknowledge the complexity of things, which are never really straightforward. But right, books I've read. I've actually finished Tony Judd, Thinking the 20th Century, the History Analysis book, which is brilliant, since we last spoke. But during the summer, I read three short books, and one of them was a book called Edging Gradually Towards Oblivion by Isla Horton Foster, who was featured in another podcast. So that's a poetry book, a great book. And it's about dealing with modern life, mental health, and also trans issues. Isla is a trans woman, and I really enjoyed reading that. The other one was The Three Escapes of Hannah Arendt, which is a little bit of a cheat because it's a graphic novel. And as I've got older, some of the best books I've read have been graphic novels for adults as well. So, in fact, I think in some of the weekend papers, they now have like graphic art novel of the week or whatever, because they've acknowledged the power of it. Hannah Arendt was a political philosopher. She escaped Nazism twice, from Germany and then from France. And then she went to the United States, and she was heavily criticized in the United States for the way that she described a lot of the... I've done a podcast recently on the Holocaust, so I've mentioned this. She actually says that some of the architects of the Holocaust were just normal people caught up in the system. And a lot of people didn't like that. They wanted these people to be portrayed as like completely evil. So she was chastised for that. But Hannah Arendt is one of those political philosophers. People from the left, the right, and all across can get particular things from her. But she was an advocate for human freedom, and said society can't just be like one big narrative. It's lots of different things. And people on the right say she was like very much about freedom. But she was also someone who migrated around the world, and she was a big defender of the right of people to have statehood and to be able to find safety elsewhere. So she's a great writer, not the easiest person to read, but the depth of her analysis was phenomenal in a very much male-dominated kind of political philosophy, very male-dominated when she wrote. So yeah, I would recommend that. And the other book I've read is, this is a bit of a cheat, it's a health book. I've got a genetic illness. It's about diet solutions to my illness. It's called Behçet's Disease, The Diet Solution by Helmut Schroeder. Sorry, the writer of the Hannah Arendt book is Ken Krimstein. And this book looks at how people can use it's not the eliminator diet. It's where you stop eating certain foods, go to a baseline diet, and then see how you feel and add foods and see whether that food doesn't agree with you. So I've had a lot of success by going gluten-free recently with my health condition. Great. And that's a good book. I would recommend anyone with any particular conditions to explore diet, but
right,
it's not
so
easy.
Dave, we're going to move on to TV, film, and
you know,
want to talk about.
I would recommend that.
So this is new compared to last
diet
time.
Changes.
We just
and get interested
any
in
any particular TV or film
there,
or like that that's caught your eye recently? Success.
Well, I am a huge Game of Thrones fan because I love the politics of it. I mean, it's visually brilliant and the action scenes are fantastic, but I just adore the character battles and the politics and everything. So I was so, so excited for The House of Dragon. And then I was thinking, is it going to live up to it? Is it just riding on the coattails, etc.? But I've been so impressed. And what I've really liked about House of Dragon is the idea that a peace-loving king is just as dangerous as a ruthless dictator. That actually, sadly, there will always be people wanting power. And giving stability and peace to a realm isn't always the best thing, which to me was like, has to be a right thing. You know, peace is more important than anything. But it's interesting how in House of Dragon, they're going to explore this idea of what makes a good king, and is peace as important, which I can't believe I'm saying.
Yeah. I think it's interesting because, you know, you look at something like Brexit, which has happened now, and you know, I can't really think of any positives from it, but I do think that now and again in life, you do get these crises, these things that come up, and it can shake people up and get them to rethink things and to reevaluate things. And I think I said this in my Excalibur podcast, where, you know, there's peace in the Arthurian kingdom, and then some people start spreading gossip because they want power, you know, that kind of thing. But the interesting thing is, the writer of Game of Thrones uses a lot of history to inform things. So even like the Red Wedding, which we won't say what happens in the Red Wedding in the first series, of is based on an event that actually happened between two rivals. There was a celebration meal, and apparently, you know, knives were drawn, shall we say. But a lot of the stuff in it is based on history. And obviously you put a bit in there, like a bit of fantasy as well, to spice things up. But there's a lot of history in Game of Thrones. And I think all the characters, you kind of relate to all of them. Even like some of the worst characters, that you can see why they're in those positions. And I think that's why Game of Thrones is so good, because of the characters in those positions. You know, there's people who you're supposed to dislike and like, and then sometimes that switches during the series. But I think the recent one's really good. The first half hour, I was a bit cautious, in the same way that when I see a new Star Wars film, I go, what are they doing? What are they doing to it? And then once you let that guard down, it's good. What I like about this series is the first run of the series had a lot of different things going on at the same time, like go here, then there, then here, then there, and it eventually all linked together. But this is just, I think there's two or three subplots going on, and it makes it a little bit more coherent, but less dynamic. But I'm very impressed with it. I thought it was very, very good. The first three episodes I've seen, it have been very, very good, and I would recommend that to anyone.
Yeah, I also think it's interesting that the House of Targaryen, we know that when the series starts, it's a rich, powerful family and kingdom, and 200 years later, it's wiped out. So it's like, what causes that? And of course, it's from within.
Yeah.
Targaryens themselves. And I think you can see parallels with many political parties, that why have they gone from greatness to disaster? And it's infighting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, yeah. So I think that's been interesting to see how people sadly will destroy each other. So good. And one of my former students was on the set doing the catering, and he was there from 3 a.m, that's when they started filming, till 11 p.m. in Cornwall, serving them the food. So just a call out to all the films and TV we see, there's somebody serving the actor's food and the director food, to just say, without that, they wouldn't have been able to do the show.
It's incredible, isn't it? So much production goes into things like that, that, you know, you'd often think there's a romantic aspect to these kind of things. I remember watching a documentary about Blade Runner by Ridley Scott, like how tough it is being an actor, and the things that go on behind the scenes to create such a powerful end product, you know, is absolutely incredible. I just want to give a shout out, by the way, to another book I've read, which I forgot about, called The Restless Kings, Henry II, His Sons. That's a great book by Nick Barrett. And it literally, I mean, you talk about Game of Thrones, you just read a book about the Plantagenets and about the Hundred Years' War. And Game of Thrones, often, like, have you ever watched the film and gone, that's a bit far-fetched, isn't it? And then you realise that the actual events happened, you know, the central events in the drama actually happened, and reality itself is just so powerful. You don't need to create things, but the infighting amongst the empire of Henry II and his sons, Richard the Lionheart, people were stabbing themselves in the back all the time. And as you say, it often comes from within, that quest for power and lack of trust. This is how kingdoms are made and how kingdoms collapse. But there's a lot of good history and a lot of good examination of psychology in Game of Thrones, as well as it being a fantastic story.
Another TV show I absolutely adore is Outlander.
Oh, yeah.
And the Outlander is the idea of Claire is a modern, independent woman at the end of the Second World War. She's a nurse, should be a doctor, right? And she goes to Scotland, and this is a bit of time travel. She goes back to 1743. She walks through these stones. She has this magical connection, and she meets Jamie, who is a Jacobite fighting for Scotland's freedom. And they fall in love, but they also try to stop Culloden Moor in 1745 with the slaughter of all the clans. And I don't think I've sold it at all, because it's just magnificent and romantic, but also powerful. And it reminded many people in Scotland of their history, which they've forgotten. A bit like Derry Girls, which is hilarious, but also reminded so many people of the troubles in Northern Ireland and the Good Friday Agreement, which sadly, with Brexit, we forgot.
Mm.
So I think shows like Outlander, Derry Girls, are very good entertainment, but also educate.
Absolutely. And 24 years after the Good Friday Agreement, who'd have thought that it would have took so soon for this to be absolutely ridiculous? I haven't seen Outlander, but I have caught an episode, and it was very well made. And the time traveling element, some people might say, oh, I'm not watching it with time traveling, but it's actually done brilliant, you know, the characters and the situations that they're in. And my sister actually lives in the village where it was filmed, a small village called Cúras, Cúrss. And a lot of people who love Outlander go to the village, and I think there's a little shop there that celebrates Outlander. But it is very well written. And as you say, the episode I saw was, I think there was a Jacobite hiding in a barn talking to someone, and it was really good, but I've never watched the full series, so I might give that a go, actually, from the start, if I can find the time.
Oh, just that they had the opportunity, because the story moves country, and they could have gone to film in America, and they didn't. The production company have kept everything in Scotland, so, you know, all the staff, you know, from carpenters to photographers to cameramen and women, it's all there. There's a huge Scottish TV industry now because of Outlander, and I think that's great.
No, that is good.
Very cold filming.
Yeah. In Scotland. There's a Welsh drama I watched a few years ago called Hinterland about a police officer.
Oh, yeah.
And it's set in Aberystwyth. But a lot of the murders and the things that happen go into the hinterlands around it, hence the name. But that really captures the place. And, you know, they don't speak in English all the time. They speak in Welsh sometimes with subtitles, and they go back and forth. And I think that it's great when you get that sense of the local in the film production, rather than it being some kind of global thing. I think that adds to it. One example is The Wire, which I think we discussed last time, which was set in Baltimore. Because it was in Baltimore, he got away with a lot of what you might call social criticism, because he was slightly removed from the main areas of film and TV production, which was excellent. It's a fantastic film about the war on drugs, but also a lot of other things. Sorry, a fantastic series. Have you checked out the new Lord of the Rings? Are you a Lord of the Rings fan?
Not much. I started, and then I thought, I will wait, because if I like it, I want to watch a lot.
Mm.
So I thought, I can't just dip into this.
Yeah.
So would you recommend it?
Yeah, it's good. And again, I'm a Lord of the Rings fan. I will say, and I think this is almost a little bit of a criticism of the films as well, the three films, which I think are excellent generally, is that I think there's a bit of ham acting in it, where people are a bit over the top. So some of the, what we might call the smaller characters, without giving the game away, in the modern series, in the later series, I think they're a bit over the top. But again, each to their own. But the plot's brilliant. It's about the time before Lord of the Rings. So some of the characters who were in Lord of the Rings, some of the elves, because elves live forever, apparently, unless you kill them. So they're in it. And it's about the Dark Lord before Sauron, and how Sauron like comes back to power. But I don't want to give too much away, but a lot of the characters are really interesting, and there's a lot of dynamics which obviously add so much depth to the world. And it's a bit funny, like, you know, like the way that you've got the Star Wars films where, like, 20 years after the originals, they made some that were earlier.
Yes.
And it's interesting seeing how the world is further developed and elaborated. But I really enjoyed it. So I'm on the second episode now, and I'm watching that. I'm watching Game of Thrones and another series called Euphoria. So I'm going back and forth to try and make them last as long as possible, because I'll talk about Euphoria in a minute, but Lord of the Rings, I would recommend it, not just if you're a Lord of the Rings fan, but if you are, I'd recommend, obviously, read the books. Check out the films first if you want to get into the Lord of the Rings world. There's also the three Hobbit films, which are good, before you check out the series. So definitely recommend it. But interestingly enough, I'm actually listening to a podcast, which I'm going to recommend to you, David, now, and it's called Backlisted. And basically, there's a few gentlemen on it who are quite well-spoken, who've obviously studied English literature, but they basically review a book by a prominent author, but they look at the works that they're not so well known for.
Okay.
And the discussion is absolutely excellent. Now, I'm never going to read half these books, but I just pick my episodes. But it's called Backlist. It's been going for a few years, and it's absolutely brilliant. I can't recommend it. If you like books, the apps that talk about books and, you know, literary theory and character, and you read a little bit from it as well, and then you go, wow, that's brilliant. You know, that's a good podcast called Backlisted. But they did an episode on The Return of the King, which is the third of the three books of Lord of the Rings. And the episode is from the 23rd of July, 2018. And that's Backlisted. But check out that podcast and pick books that you like and listen to them talk about them and go, wow, I hadn't thought about that. But they do pick books that aren't as well known by particular authors. But that's a great podcast I've started listening to. Basically, on the back of our first podcast on books, I said, I'm going to see if there's something else out there like that.
I'm also reading the Wolf Hall trilogy.
Oh, yeah.
By Hilary Mantel,
yeah.
Which I think is just astonishing.
Yeah.
I mean, on the second one now, is it Bring the Bodies?
Bring Up the Bodies.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah.
So it's looking at the rise of Jane Seymour, but it's all the. I think I'm fascinated by the power play of people, whether it's just in the staff room or it's in the royal court. It's just how people operate and why they want power.
Strange, isn't it? Strange. Yeah. But, like, I know, like, a lot of postmodern analysts get called, oh, you go on about power too much. You know, it's not all about power. Often people on the right criticize that. But really, the dynamics of power interaction, you know, even in your own home, the central to everything. I mean, you can give it a different label if you want, but it is interesting. But as you say, you know, you read Hilary Mantel, do you need to make it enough for something like Game of Thrones? You know, the intrigue. Real events, but she's. I don't know if you've ever seen her getting interviewed, Hilary Mantel. She would appear to be, like, you know, quite, how would I describe it? I don't want to say neurotic, but she obviously sees the world in a different way, and her ability to write reflects that. I've read another of her books about a ghost, and it was really good the way she wrote it. But she's very gifted, and those three novels, I think the third one was released a few years ago, were, like, you know, international acclaim, aren't they? But I might check those out. The other series, just going back to Euphoria. Euphoria is a series, there's been two series, and I watched an episode of it. And while I was watching it, I thought to myself, this is the best episode of any TV I've ever seen. And I don't want to say that because people will then go to the episode and go, well, it wasn't that good, but I just want to say there's an episode where one of the characters in it, Rue, has a one-to-one with her mentor from Narcotics Anonymous. And it's on Christmas Eve, and they're in a diner in the suburbs of some American city. And the two characters, it starts off somewhere else, but it's basically them two talking to each other for the whole episode. And I have not heard dialogue like it, not only just about the nature of addiction, but just about life generally. And it was just absolutely beautiful. And I then subsequently learned that wasn't the first episode, that the two specials The two specials are between series one and series two. So I watched one of the specials and then went back. But it's basically about young people in suburban America who seem to be fairly well off from fairly well off backgrounds. But it's about social media, sex, the online world, power relations, addiction, and just the strains and stresses of growing up. And it doesn't depict it romantically. These people are going through it, but materially they are wealthy, it would appear. Like, and the acting is first rate, the music is first rate, and the script is first rate. And right. It's quite graphic. There's quite a bit of violence. There's references to drugs. There's some horrible characters in it. There's a drug dealer in it. There's a few, but one of the drug dealers in it who's got tattoos on his face. I've seen a lot of drug dealers depicted through a film. This guy terrified me. And I said, he is the most convincing drug dealer, like hard man I've ever seen on TV. And all the characters, the acting is just phenomenal. The only thing I'd say about it, it's about addiction and growing up and, you know, sex and all that. It won't be everyone's cup of tea. Some people might go, I don't really want to watch that. But it's some of the most fantastic art, musically, acting-wise, and script I've ever seen, and I would highly recommend it. And I hope I haven't built it up too much, whereas other people say, oh, it wasn't that good. But check out Euphoria and just treat yourself to just beautiful dialogue, script, and acting about real life issues. Just indulge yourself. So I'd recommend that. Really good. Really good.
Right. Well, thank you very much, because I definitely will. Have you seen The Newsroom?
I have seen Newsroom. Brilliant.
Yeah. Just so intelligent. I love the scene, because it's set obviously in a newsroom, and you've got the pressure either to become popular with ratings and be silly and shallow, or be intelligent and explain society to its viewers. And there's that magnificent scene on being asked what makes America the greatest country in the world. Yeah. And that scene alone is just superb.
Yeah, that I've watched that scene a few times, and that is the greatest scene I've seen about the American project and the American dilemma. So you've got, just for people who are watching, you've got a Democrat and a Republican going head to head on a TV show. And there's a guy there who runs a newsroom, and he's a Republican, isn't he? But he's like one of these Republicans who now you'd be absolutely crying out for a sensible Republican who isn't nuts, who believes in QAnon and all this, and Donald Trump. And he just comes out with this woman says, why is America the greatest country in the world? Now, we know about this nationalism. You know, you put, oh, you're a proper patriot, you know, and you say, well, actually, patriots want their country to be better and will criticise certain aspects of their country to make it better. And this woman asked this, like, you know, leading question, and he just absolutely wipes the floor with it. And that scene is just absolutely brilliant. And what, do you know what is so good about that show? It's that it only did three series. It went a bit off the ball, you know, after the first series. The first series of that is absolutely incredible. And the script is written by the guy who did The West Wing. He's a very good writer. I forget his name now.
Aaron
Sorkin. Brilliant. And that predicted Trumpism. I think that was released just before Trump came to power. And basically it was an appeal that if we don't stop and look at what we're about in this country from a kind of safe liberal, let's support the Republic, let's support the Constitution. It's not like a radical show by any means, but I think it was almost like a warning. You know, bad times are going to come if we're not careful. And since 2016, we've seen that on both sides of the Atlantic. And it absolutely terrifies me that Trump might come back, that Johnson might come back, and that these forces of anti-democracy, tribal disregard for minorities or other groups' rights, as long as your message gets across and that you're okay, that's all that matters. I think it's a real a real warning for the future. But The Newsroom, the first series, is just absolutely incredible. Have you watched it all yet?
Yeah, I thought it was great. But Aaron Sorkin won't do TV again because he was unhappy with the script. I think he rewrote and rewrote that pilot. And he said that's why he likes film, because you can spend ages on it. And when you're only happy with the script, can you film? Mm. But with TV, because it's constant, you don't get that chance. But I thought it was such an intelligent, captivating show. This is a terrible confession. I discovered TikTok this week.
Mm.
And before I knew it, I'd been through 100 videos in half an hour. And the second it didn't capture my imagination, I flicked again. And I thought, what am I doing? So it's difficult now. Audiences expect greatness, where I think 20 years ago, we were happy with good drama.
Yeah, some of the dramas, the great dramas of the past, you look at them now, and I've found it with film now, because I'm watching Euphoria, Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones at the moment. I'll put a couple of films on which have been recommended to me and thought after 15 minutes, I haven't got time for this. And I think you miss a lot of gems that way, particularly with books. I mean, that's TV. I mean, in the past, people have put a film on and watch it, wouldn't they? Now it's like, nope, because of the attention economy and because of the multitude of stuff you can watch. It is worrying, isn't it? Do you know TikTok? I've been advised to use that to help with the podcast, and I might go into that world. But I use Twitter for the podcast now, but I don't go on Twitter. Twitter is it's the vilest. You know that, like, inner voice, that negative inner voice? It's just that written down with people being Machiavellian to each other and having a go at each other. It's awful.
I think it's got some good points as well, but with young people and books, book talk on TikTok is huge, and young people are actually reading and discussing what they read, which is magnificent.
Yeah, I think we mentioned that on the last podcast. I think you mentioned that. But that is good. That is good, because that helps you find a way, doesn't it?
Yeah, so I would, and I think if we all opt out of like TikTok or Twitter because of the negativity, it won't make the trolls behave better or stop. They'll just get worse.
Absolutely. I think with Twitter as well, I go on, I release podcasts on there, do a little bit, and then get off it. I just try to use it positively. And I had a friend recently who said he left because he was getting into arguments with people. Anyway, he's back on, and I saw him the other week having an argument with someone over something, and I just thought, I don't need that. And again, it's like editing. You can use it positively, or you can use it negatively, can't you? So onwards and upwards. Right, David, thank you for giving me your precious time on a Saturday. Anything else you want to discuss?
No, just thank you so much for having me back. And it's just a joy to discuss books and film and everything, because I think art, someone said, is the fictional way we present the truth of our lives. You know, so I think it's great, you know. So I'm going to carry on reading and watching TV, and that's it.
And that's a good way to finish. And I just want to say as well, you know, since becoming a father, I read less, but life without reading, I can't imagine ever. I never go anywhere without a book. I never go anywhere without a book. The other week I went somewhere, never brought my book with me, and I brought a book with me. I didn't have any chance to read it, but if my car breaks down, or I'm on a bus or a train,
I'll confess this, that I was reading John Williams' Stoner.
Oh, what a book.
Brilliant, brilliant book. But I had 15 pages to go, and I was going from Liverpool to Manchester, and I thought, if I take my copy, I'll have to carry my copy round and I'll have finished it, right? So in Liverpool, I bought a new copy of it from W.H. Smith. This is terrible. I read it in May. And then when I got off in Manchester, I returned it to the W.H. Smith there.
I think that's fair enough. I think that's a good contribution, because you've already bought the book and, you know, you've already read it. But
always have a book. And can I say as well that if you like audiobooks,
yeah,
right, Sefton Libraries have something called Borrow Book, and Liverpool Libraries have something called Libby, and there's thousands upon thousands of books, audiobooks for free.
Yeah, yeah. I've
so, you know, please, you know, your listeners, please use those. Use your library, and if they don't have the books you want, ask, yeah, and they might buy them. But the audiobooks are wonderful and free.
Yeah,
because of the prices, it's hard to access material.
I take my son to the library every 3 weeks to get him a little book, and I have a look around there. I just think it's a great resource to support and to keep going. I think also sharing books and passing books on, you know, just do it. And I mean, I don't have too many books on my shelves anymore because I give a lot away, but I think that's a good thing too. Thanks for your wonderful insights into the world of literature and art today, David.
Yeah. I was just going to say, for your son, there's a picture book called Have You Seen My Hat?
My Hat.
By John Clavin. I think it is by him. Brilliant.
Right. I'm going to shortlist that now on the internet and have a look at getting them nappers for Christmas.
So funny. But thank you so much again.
No worries. It's been an absolute pleasure. Folks, let us know what you think of this podcast. If you can, share, subscribe on Spotify and YouTube. Share it with 3 friends. Please like. It really does matter. It really does help with this project moving forward. If you want to come on, get in touch. If you can make the financial contribution of a cup of coffee once a month, go to coffee.com. Details in the notes. That would be great if you can do that. If not, don't worry about it. And spread the word. So thanks everyone for listening. Thanks, David. And have a wonderful Saturday, everyone. Or whatever day in the week it is when you hear this.
Thank you.